The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today it's the New York Times bestselling author of All Necessary Force, Brad Taylor. He's got a brand new book. It's Enemy of Mine. This another Pike Logan thriller. Brad, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Tell me a little bit about Pike Logan.
He's kind of a compilation of people I've known and I've served with. Originally, I wanted to write a story of redemption just because I kind of like that theme. But you write what you know. So, I mean, if I'd have been a police officer or a priest or something like that, the plot line would have changed, but Pike Logan would remain the same.
All right. Now, you, in the service, retired, I believe, a lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm.
And in Delta Force.
Mm-hmm.
Navy SEAL?
No, that's nope. Navy. I'm Army.
Okay, Army. I thought maybe, you know, with Delta Force, maybe they put you in there anyway. Tell me a little bit about your time of service and with your books. Mm-hmm. Delta Force, I'm sure you've got a lot of things that the government won't let you talk about. Do they have to take a look at the book and say, okay, this is okay or this isn't?
Actually, I have people read it. I proactively give it to people before I send it out, and they read it, and I just basically say, is there anything in here that would harm national security? Anything in here that guys are still operational? Is there something in here that you don't want in here? Because the bottom line is, there's only so many ways to skin a cat. And I when I write something, I sometimes paint myself in a corner because I'm like, the only way to solve this problem is some classified piece of technology, which I'm not going to use. But so I invent something or I use something that's real world, and then it could end up being real, you know, in classified information. So I guess the answer is that a lot of guys do read it and come back to me and tell me what to put in, what not to.
Some of the things in the book, I mean, this has a great hook right off the bat where there's a lady coming in. She's got a suitcase handcuffed to her wrist.
Mm-hmm.
She's been talking to somebody that a government wants this information.
Right.
And somebody's out to kill her.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in the very first few pages, we know that she's not going to make it anyway.
Right.
But she has a little tag that pretty much tells who you are, where you're going, mm-hmm. or it's for the...
it's called a RFID tag, and they sound like black magic, but they're in use all over the world. Walmart uses them to track things. Department of Defense uses them for end items. Easy passes work off of them, speed pass at a gas station. And all the airlines were losing so much luggage because they use a barcode. Well, a reader's got to read that barcode. It's got to be in line of sight of the barcode. So if the bag falls over to the right instead of the left, that bag could get rerouted to, you know, Chicago instead of Cincinnati. And then the airlines are paying for money. So they use RFID tags nowadays. A lot of the airlines are going to it. And all it really has in it is everything that's on the outside of the tag anyway. So it goes 360, puts out a radio signal, so it doesn't matter how that bag's laying, the reader will pick it up.
This tag was used to more or less blow up the lady.
Yeah, used as a trigger. Because it's a single identification. If she's dragging that bag, they'd done surveillance on her and said she always goes by herself. She's got her bag. And that RFID signal is a key indicator. So when it breaks into the RFID line, the explosives go off, and she's got her bag with her. She's in the ring of fire.
Everything you put in there can happen,
oh, certainly. Yeah, really? Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of the book, they use the RFID, same thing. At the beginning and the end, all the passports nowadays from 2007 on have an RFID chip in the passport, which that has much more information in it than just the bag tag. It's got your picture, your passport information, your date of birth, everything. When they first came out, there was a big consternation about identity theft. And the State Department said, no, you can't do it. And a bunch of college kids went out and got an RFID reader, which you can get on the internet for pennies, and went to the airport and started picking up IDs. And so the State Department came back and said, okay, well, maybe we're wrong about that. Now the passports have a wire mesh embedded in it. And the only way you can read it is when you open it up.
I think dogs have something like this embedded in them. Is that correct?
Well, yes. Actually, I'm doing research for Book 5, actually, in the it's going to be in Mexico. And they're selling these RFID implants for very rich Mexican nationals because it's supposed kidnapping is a big deal down there. And supposedly this thing's going to, you know, if they get kidnapped, it's inside their bicep and you can track them. But the truth of the matter is, your RFID signal is very limited. So you have to carry also this big GPS device, which kind of defeats the purpose. They'll just take that and throw it away. Now it's not going to do anything. But yeah, it's the same thing they use for dogs. When they scan the dog, when they put the RFID chip in them, that's what it comes out.
So people are already getting these. Do you see a time where everybody will get one?
No, because right now the technology is not there. They'll advertise that this chip is GPS location, all this. That's not. It's RFID puts out a very, very, very weak signal. The only thing it does is, the reason they use them on pets is it identifies a pet. Pet runs away, pet can't talk, can't speak English. You can run it over there and find out who the pet is. But putting it in humans, kind of, if a guy can talk, there's no reason to have it. I am John Doe, here's who I am, that kind of thing.
With Enemy of Mine, of course, you've got two other books in this. What was the challenges of the very first book that you ever wrote as opposed to Enemy of Mine?
Well, the challenge of the very first book was simply writing a book, to be perfectly honest with you. I have had no formal writing instruction. I've always been a voracious reader, and I set out to write just what I wanted to read. But you have your entire life to write your first book. And I really thought I'd sit on a nighttime, the nightstand, not go anywhere. And then I wrote book two. Well, one of the things, you kind of feel internal pressure to keep amping it up. And I consciously, an Enemy of Mine, pulled back from that. The first two books dealt with a global caliphate, Al-Qaeda threat, weapon of mass destruction in one, and dropping the electrical grid in the other. And this one, I focus on a single killing of a single man, the Mideast envoy. It's just going to be an assassination plot on a single man. And so I purposely wanted to pull back from some kind of giant thing.
Yeah, but in this book, you still have different threads going in and out.
Yes.
Weaved pretty good.
Yes, definitely.
Was the first book also like that?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
It was.
And everything you learn just by reading, and I hear that's the best way to do it anyway.
I worked with an editor for the first book, and I learned, the first book literally did not have chapters in it. And my editor said, "Is this some kind of literary device?" And I said, quite honestly, "No, I don't know how to do chapters." So I learned a lot from her about, this is about pacing, about characterization, things like that. That I picked up pretty quickly. And so book two was a lot easier to write, and book three was easier still.
Enemy of Mine, I crack that open. You can get right into it, whether you've really read the first one or not, mm-hmm. But you always should start with the first one.
You can. They're all three of the books are standalones, although this one, Enemy of Mine, ended up being kind of a trilogy. It kind of closed the circle because I brought back Lucas Cain, who's Lucas Cain's a bad guy in book one, and I let him go. And I thought, I did it because I thought it was a good way to end the book. Another guy needed some justice, and he delivers justice, but in order to do that, he's going to get away. And everybody kind of accused me of setting up a hook for book two. Well, I didn't even know there was going to be a book two, so that wasn't the case. Well, then All Necessary Force, book two, came out, and he's not in it. It's a standalone book. And then I started getting a lot of fan mail about, hey, where's Lucas Cain? So I framed this one up. Like I said, I pulled away from Al-Qaeda, and I wanted to look at different terrorist groups. In America, we have a monolithic attitude towards terrorism. We see Abu Bag of Donuts, and they're all the same. When in fact they're wildly different in their goals and political objectives and things like that. So I wanted to write about Hamas, Hezbollah, Palestine, Israel, Syria, all that. So I was framing it up and I started getting these emails and I said, well, I'll pull in Lucas Cain. I'll bring him back. And he ended up consuming the book. He was a very central figure in the book. And I didn't want to just bring him back just for, everybody said bring him back. So he's got to be an integral part of the plot. And I thought, what would be a better way is this assassin's trying to kill the Mideast envoy, terrorist. How about Lucas Cain's trying to kill the assassin at the same time that Pike's trying to kill the assassin? Now, Lucas Cain, Red Book One, he's the most hated enemy of Pike Logan. Pike doesn't even know who he is, but he knows what he's done. And that's where the title came from. The enemy of my enemy is my friend is an Arabic proverb. And now he's got Lucas Cain and Pike Logan are inadvertently working together to stop this assassin.
You've got an interesting character in here, Krusty,
yes.
Named after Krusty the Clown
right.
On The Simpsons. Tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, well, when you're doing real operations, you always give the guy some kind of, the Arabic names are too hard to say over the radio, too hard to spell. You have kunyas that are really long, they'll change their name over and over. One guy, like I said, Abu Bag of Donuts, real name could be something completely different. And so they'll always get some kind of call sign, whether it's just their initials for Osama bin Laden's UBL, or they'll get some kind of nickname. And in this case, this guy looked like Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons, and they started calling him Krusty, and that was his call sign when they were chasing him.
All right, tell me, Krusty the Clown, he's pretty much got this house. There's one of the operatives in there. They're trying mm-hmm. to get all the information they can.
Right.
This guy figures out he's being watched, huh?
Right. They thought he figured out there was a task force watching, but it turns out it was just a coincidence. He's actually got some history, too. He was in book one, but he was just a bit thing. They pulled a team off of him to go to help Pike out. But he thinks he's being watched by the government. Now, the task force, which is, in fact, watching him, thinks that they've been burned, and he knows that they're on to him. And so that's why they do an in-extremist takedown to get rid of him.
All right. Now, how do you bring this thing to life? Because there are parts in here that you can just see everything that's happening, from the very first thing, from when the guy goes through the plate glass window to a mosque where I think Krusty's in a full burqa.
Right.
How do you do that?
Well, a lot of it's a combination of both personal experience. First, people ask me, is this faction? You know, have you done these things? And that's not the case. I write fiction, period. I don't write about anything I've ever seen or done because it's classified. But having said that, you can't help but rely on your own experiences to write stuff. Like I tell people, you know, if you were going to write a scene in a grocery store, what would be the first thing you'd do? You'd think about the last grocery store you were in, and that's how you'd write the scene. So when I'm writing these scenes, I have to pull my own experiences, and they show on the page. But the other side is just an enormous amount of research. I mean, I went to Dubai, Qatar, Frankfurt, looked at all those places. A lot of things, if I can physically get there, I'll get there. And if it's in the book and I've been there, that's exactly what I saw. And a lot of the things, it's the tail wagging the dog. I don't show up in a country and say, I'm going to go look at all these things and then write my book. I'll show up in a country with a blank slate. For instance, the ghost, the main terrorist, gets lost in Deira looking for electronic soup to buy the MZ grabber. That's because I got lost in Deira trying to find that electronic soup. And I was wandering around out there in the heat and I finally found it. And so when I write the book, it's the same way. That the ghost safe house is in the third floor of a spice souk. And I was led up to the third floor of a spice souk for some guy trying to sell me fake Rolexes. I went up there. I had no intention of buying a watch, but I wanted to see what was up there. It was suitable. It ends up in the book. And in fact, in Enemy of Mine, Brett does buy the watch and walks out.
A thriller, would you say international thriller? Would you say spy novel? How would you classify
it? It's kind of a combination. I say more military thriller, but it definitely has a lot of intelligence aspects to it, as opposed to just running and gunning type things. And it's definitely international because it goes all over.
Brad, let's talk a little bit about your service across the pond here. Delta Force, I guess, who hasn't seen the movie? Is it anything like the movie?
No, not at all. That's absolutely not. I can't talk a whole lot about the unit itself. It's classified, but I served 21 years in Special Forces and about 8 years in the unit doing operations all over.
So what does it take to get into a special unit like that?
It takes a long time. What they're really looking for beyond anything else is a problem solver. You've got to have the skill sets. You've got to be able to, you know, do all the physical training and be able to shoot and things like that. But that's a bare minimum. You could be a triathlete and an ace shot, a biathlon in the Olympics, but if you can't make a morally correct decision on the X, be a problem solver, that's what is a cut above. You can't just walk off the street and go into the unit. It took me 10 years to get there.
MacGyver, he probably would have been a great asset.
Yeah. He'd have been perfect. In fact, that's what we used to say, things like, MacGyver that thing, when you're trying to get out of some kind of problem.
All right, now, you were in a couple wars here back, what, maybe 10, 15 years ago?
Well, no, since 9/11, I just retired 2 years ago, so when 9/11 happened, I was deployed pretty much since then.
Okay, so did you have anything to do with Iraq, Iran? I mean, I'm sure
yeah,
you did.
Yeah, sure.
Both countries.
I was quite possibly, well, maybe one of the first guys on the in Afghanistan after 9/11. I've served in Iraq numerous times, so yeah.
Is it getting better?
Which one?
Any of them.
Iraq's got a problem with it's a hodgepodge of Kurds, Shia, and Sunni, and most people, Kurds are a ethnicity, and the same split inside Kurdistan is the same split Shia-Sunni worldwide. There's 80% Sunni, 20% Shia, but they hold Kurdistan above their religion, and that's what fuses them together. Then you go south, and you've got Shia and Sunnis. There's more Shia in Iraq than Sunnis. The Sunnis were in charge and persecuted the Shias. Now the Shia are in charge, and Sunnis don't like it. So it's a lot of ethnic tension going on.
America, the melting pot of the world. Do you ever see maybe the problems that other countries are having happening in this country?
I do. There's the other countries, they've got the Muslims are moving into Europe at an astounding rate, and they're not assimilating into the culture precisely because the other cultures inside Europe are much more closed. So, you know, Francophone, if you're French, you're French, and the other people can live here, but they'll never be French. Luckily, America's not like that. But it's a two-way street. You have to be wanting to embrace what American ideals are. And there are some people come over, some enclaves that come over, and I'm using Islam, but it could be anything. There's all kinds that come over and want to maintain their own heritage, their own culture, and they build little enclaves, and that's where the separation starts happening.
Enemy of Mine, why was this book set in the places that it was?
Well, specifically, as I was alluding to earlier, I wanted to talk about terrorist groups with finite political goals, and as another part of the title, Hamas is something completely different from Hezbollah, something it's very similar to the Fatah and the Palestinian Authority, but Hamas hates the Palestinian Authority. They're trying to be the legitimate leaders of the Palestinian people. Right now, the Palestinian Authority is legitimate leaders, and those two have had a huge war. Hamas owns the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority owns the West Bank, and they're trying to form and reconcile a government right now. Well, Hamas was funded by Syria and funded by Iran. They were formed by the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt. Their biggest enemy was Mubarak in Egypt. So you had an enemy of my enemy is my friend thing going on. Hamas is Sunni, Hezbollah is Shia. They both had a common goal, so they were siding with each other. What happens in today's world? Mubarak's out, Muslim Brotherhood's in, Syria's under fire, he's crushing the Sunnis, Syria is Shia. Hamas then stood up and said, we no longer like you, Assad. We side with the Sunni population on the ground, which didn't make a lot of press here, but it caused a lot of consternation in the Arabic world because both Iran and Assad are saying that this is all fomented by Western intelligence organizations. It's a fake insurgency. Well, now you've got a terrorist organization that everybody in the West despises siding with the insurgency. How could they possibly be a Western thing? So it's kind of the enemy of my enemy. Sometimes you're friends, sometimes you're not. And all those guys have their own political goals. And I wanted to show that. I really wanted to capture the essence of what the tangled stuff that goes on over there. Because we kind of look at everything as a single scope. Who are they? They hate Americans. Well, it's much bigger than that. You know, they may not like us, but they've got bigger ambitions than us. I mean, Hamas has never directly attacked the United States.
I think the libertarians came out and they were saying, you know, we really shouldn't be in all these places. We should take care of our own place. How do you feel about that?
I think that's misguided. That's a very, very narrow, shallow view of the world. You can't possibly, especially with the global interconnectivity we have now with the internet and everything else, you cannot possibly not engage in these places and expect to do anything. It's easy to say, let's just pull out and let it go. And I mean, one of my favorite things I hear all the time is, you know, let's end the war. Well, if that's all it took, you know, is just pulling out, well, we could have pulled out, you know, 1941, we should have said, hey, they bombed Pearl Harbor. You know what? I'm going to end this war. I'm not going to do anything about it. I mean, the enemy gets a vote. The war is going to go whether you're there or not. I mean, we are more appropriate to say, let's pull out of here and let those guys slaughter each other.
Enemy of Mine, along with the other Pike Logan thrillers, you've talked to readers in this book. What are some of the things they say about some of the things that you put in here, like that tag that can actually explode a bomb? Mm-hmm. And there are other things in here that it's almost mind-boggling for somebody that's not in the service.
Right. Well, a lot of the stuff that's in there is, there's only one piece of kit that's in there that I really kind of stretch the truth. The EMP gun they use to knock out critical components for alarm leads and things like that. The grand truth is, and it's explained in the book, that DARPA, which is a research agency for the Department of Defense, is in fact building and doing research on an EMP gun, but it's using it for disabled cars. An EMP, for the listeners, is an electromagnetic pulse. You've probably heard about it. With nuclear blast, it'll knock out every electronic in the universe type thing. Well, you can also make a smaller version of it. You can make it in your kitchen, actually. And they're trying to make one that'll knock out cars because every car nowadays has some computer component to it, electronic fuel injection or whatever. And the purpose of it is so you no longer have to throw out spike strips or no longer be a big car chase. Somebody starts running from the law, you zap them with the EMP gun, his car's disabled. Well, right now, that thing is about the size of a kitchen table. And so they're doing research to make it smaller. They want to get shoulder mounted. And I just extrapolated that and said the task force money is no object. And they've done the research and made it. But the other pieces of stuff that's in there, it's real. The Skyhook is something that's really used, was used. We just retired it. MZ Grabber, the International Mobile Subscriber identity number that every single phone has. An MZ Grabber is basically a device that duplicates itself like a cell phone. And it's used by criminals to exploit your cell phone, listen to your calls, and used by law enforcement for tracking. Basically, when your phone goes out, it looks for the nearest tower. And if you have an MZ grabber, it thinks that's a tower and it locks into that tower. I mean, it's a real device.
Yeah, there was a part in here where they were taking pictures and sending it to the receiver and they could tell exactly where they were. They do carry a GPS unit in the phone.
Exactly. Well, the phones, most of almost all phones, in fact, I think in the United States, it's required now because of 911 purposes. Every phone's got to have a GPS locator device in it. So when you call 911, I just had a massive accident, they can figure out where your phone is. In the past, they just triangulated through cell towers, and it's up to, you know, a mile off. But yeah, photos now are geotagged as well, and that's one of the things people, if you're listening, don't put your photos on Facebook because it's probably got a geotag in it. Somebody can pull that take the photo down, get the geo coordinates of it, and so they can locate. You know, if you put up, hey, I'm on vacation, here's a picture of my house, and they got a grid to your house, they can go find your house and break in.
Really?
Yeah. There's a lot of the cameras now have embedded geo coordinates in it because people like to. If you go to Google Earth and you see those pictures that come up, somebody took a geotag picture and just loaded it into Google Earth. Google Earth extracts the geotag data from that and then correctly places it on the map. The people aren't actually going to the city and saying, this is where I took it, I'm going to put it here. The geotag is in the picture itself. And in this case, in order to find out where you are, instead of somebody saying, take a left here, take a right here, take a left here, he says, I'm going to take a photo of this place. It's got a geotag in it, send him the photo. Now my phone extracts that data, then turns on the GPS and gives me turn-by-turn directions of how to get there.
I'm not really familiar with that, but is that an app you have to get, or any phone will do that?
Oh, no, no. What they're using here is definitely created for... It's an application, a specific application created by the task force. It's not... You know, I haven't really looked to see if there's an app. There probably is one. But you'd have to have, you know, like embedded with Google Maps, it would pull it up and start running with it.
That seems kind of dangerous, especially, I mean, for kids on Facebook.
Oh, yeah.
They just figure out where all these kids are.
Yeah, definitely. And people, I always turn off my GPS stuff on anything I've got because it is a known threat. And if people Google it, there's a lot of people saying don't put geotag photos up on the net because it's people can extract that data and definitely use it.
So you can actually turn that off and take pictures and it wouldn't tell where anything is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every phone's got, there's a location services tab on it. And you, like my iPhone right now, any app will say, I want to use location services. All of them for me say no. If I want them to do it, I'll turn off that specific location for, like, I need to find a location on Google Maps. I'll turn on that one time, then turn it off again.
Brad, you mentioned Enemy of Mine, a Pike Logan thriller, the third in the trilogy. Is that it for Pike Logan?
No, not at all. I say trilogy just because that's how it ended up. People always say, you know, what are you going to do for book 7? I'm like, I didn't know there was going to be a book 3. I mean, I certainly didn't plan it out. It's definitely free flow. But I did just finish, next week I'll get the copy edits for The Widow's Strike, which comes out this summer. And it's a task force, Pike and Jennifer are back at it. I moved away from the Middle East because I cannot predict the Arab Spring. Enemy of Mine actually was heavily centered on Syria and Lebanon initially. And I have a friend of mine, a Special Forces guy, who was working in the Damascus Embassy, and he invited me over to do research. I did a lot of talking with him about Hezbollah and things like that. He's a definite expert, smarter than I am. He speaks Arabic, Princeton grad in Arabic studies. And then Syria went up in flames. And so he was dealing with car bombs and closing the embassy down. I couldn't go. And so I had to do a lot of research through books. And Syria, it was a lot of rewrites in the book. I had to really take Syria down. Well, Unnecessary Force, book 2, I made that in Egypt. And then that place went up in flames. I had to do a lot of rewrites on that. So I said, I'm through with the Arab Spring. So book 4, The Widow's Strike, is Southeast Asia.
With the special ops, it sounded like in the book that women haven't been involved in special ops that much until maybe recently.
I mean, there's congressional limitations of what a unit woman can serve in. So certainly there are analysts, there are, you know, parachute riggers, there are things, quartermasters that are open to women, but there's not any women operators that are, you know, toting a gun and shooting people.
Okay, because Jennifer sounds like she's one that could really take care of herself.
Right, yeah, and so that's what you see the He-Man, Woman-Hater stuff that's going on with her is just precisely that. Now, she's not in the military, she's a civilian, and Pike's recognized skills in her that she doesn't even realize she has. And so he's brought her along, and she turns out to be pretty capable.
Pike's one guy that would like to see her in a unit like that or not?
See, he before wouldn't have. He used to be He-Man, Woman-Hater, and One Rough Man. He's grown to accept the fact that, you know, she brings something to the table that nobody else does. And Knuckles is starting to recognize it too, an Enemy of Mine. He's kind of like, you know, if we had her here, we could do this.
Looking ahead at some of the books, of course, you said that this next book, getting pretty much finished, you know where it's at and everything. Do you look ahead and do you maybe figure out where you're going to be ahead of time?
I do. I just started to. I mean, I'm still learning my way, to be honest with you. Each writing experience is a little bit different from the one before. But generally what will happen is I'll see something on the news, and it'll be at the tail end. I'll read a news article, and there'll be one little sentence in there that I'm like, huh, I didn't hear about that. And I'll start doing research on it. And as I unravel it, I'm like, that is a serious threat. And all necessary force, it's the power grid. And I'd read one thing on a vulnerability that we had in the United States power grid. And so I started doing an enormous amount of research on it. And that's how the plot formed out.
You're pretty schooled in international thrillers, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because that was your life for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
How much research do you actually have to do for a book like Enemy of Mine?
Tons. For Enemy of Mine specifically, I think I read probably 8 books on Hamas, Hezbollah, the Palestinian problem, the Levant itself, history of those areas. Because I have a pretty basic, real strong background on the basics of it, but you really got to start digging in to get the intricacies. And Enemy of Mine's got a lot of different things that are really threaded through it. Rafiq Hariri, who gets assassinated in 2006, he really did get assassinated in 2006. I picked the Al Bustan Watani Hotel in Dubai precisely because Hamas military commander was assassinated there in 2010. He really was. It was in the news. The Special Tribunal for Lebanon we were talking about earlier in the very beginning, that's a real thing. And Hezbollah is really worried about it, climbing up in the ranks because now they're in the government. So it ended up, there's a lot of real stuff that I then twisted one way or the other to make the plot work, but it's all based on fact for a lot of the things that are in there.
Brad, if we want to find out more about you, about Pike Logan and your other books, Enemy of Mine being the brand new one, where would we go? You have a website?
I do. BradTaylorBooks.com, and on that website, there's excerpts of all 3 books. They can read from there.
All right. Brad Taylor, Enemy of Mine, a Pike Logan thriller. Brad, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
I tell you what, if you want a book that's a page turner, and you know, Brad, he's got this he's got this all figured out. And you know what I liked about it? Not all the chapters are really that long or anything. It's something that you can just flip through maybe a few before you go to bed, and maybe you can get a good night's sleep, perhaps.
To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.